I firmly believe that you do not have to surrender joy and pleasure for health and wholesomeness. I really want to expand how we understand food and what our food needs to be.
Hi, I'm Christiana, and I am a nurse at the bedside. And being at the bedside, I have become quite familiar with the offerings of the hospital kitchen. The trays, what the food on them looks like, smells like, tastes like. Yes, I have tried quite a lot of it. And I've seen how patients and families react, the satisfaction they express or not, and how much of it gets eaten. Hospital food does not have a good reputation in general. Some of what is served is truly shocking, and from what I can see, it is not getting better. Burger night at our local hospital? Ugh, shudder. I remember my one-year-old daughter receiving a tray, and on the tray as the entree was a solitary, shriveled hot dog wiener and some dried-out frozen corn. Needless to say, she didn't eat it. According to the Canadian Malnutrition Task Force, and I will be referencing their data here, and you can check out their website and find quite a list of publications, here in Canada, 40 to 50% of the people who are admitted to hospital come in malnourished, especially in medical surgical wards. And people who are malnourished experience worse health outcomes, prolonged hospital stays, more frequent readmissions, and higher likelihood of mortality. So they're coming to us malnourished. And what happens once they're admitted? Well, they get the trays. I recognize that institutional food is difficult and that feeding people in a hospital or in long-term care is extra hard. Beyond just basic differences in tastes and preferences, people have very specific nutritional requirements depending on the illness and their state of recovery. They need specific food prepared in specific ways, and it changes as their condition changes. They may go multiple days without eating at all, sometimes up to 8 or 10. People need special textures because of alterations in their ability to swallow, chew. They may have altered taste, mouth or throat pain, nausea, general pain, fatigue, difficulty sitting up. It's very hard to eat soup lying on your side. Many people in hospital struggle with lack of appetite. They may have specific macronutrient needs like low fat, high protein, low carb, you know, based on their illness or chronic diseases they have. And then all the specific requirements related to electrolytes, minerals, etc. You know, like low sodium for heart failure, high sodium for GI losses, low potassium for kidney failure, high potassium for high output ileostomy. And then there are those people, the person who has heart and kidney failure and also a high output ileostomy. The challenges are endless. There is a lot of complexity to feeding people who are ill. Add in the challenges of polypharmacy, drug and food interactions, allergies, sensitivities, cultural preferences. It is super tough. Not to mention trying to keep the food hot, making it look nice. I do not discount the challenges in the assignment. But the role of food and nutrition in health is real. It's an elephant in the room. Not the only one. There are quite a number of elephants, but it is definitely one of the elephants in the hospital room. We just kind of like accept the ridiculousness, the hypocrisy, really, of counseling people more whole foods, less processed, like eat the rainbow, and then serving up food that, you know, is just not consistent with that vision. We're not practicing what we preach. And every once in a while, you encounter a patient or family who shares how disrespected they feel by the teaching they receive that really fails to address the barriers that they face and how frustrating it is for all involved. And there are those truly extreme cases, someone whose entire reason for admission is malnutrition. We run blood tests all day. We can screen and document and counsel, but we struggle to provide the basic thing they lack, decent food and the means to eat it. It's that old wisdom, right? Food as medicine and food systems as integral to the health of our communities. And we as healthcare providers are somewhat removed from it. For most of us, it's just another addition to that list we all carry of things that make you go, There's a lot of those day to day. Like, what if healing and recovery are truly dependent on being well nourished? What if eating well is really as important as we say it is? We wonder, and then we shrug, because it's out of our control and we get back to work. A friend of mine is a family doc who recently retired after a long practice in rural Ontario, and we were talking about diet and counseling, and he related a story of a patient who came back after like a 3 or 6 month follow-up, and you know, his A1C, cholesterol, blood pressure, etc., they were all improved. So we asked the patient, like, what happened here? And the patient said, oh, I did what you said. Started eating more whole foods, more veggies and fruits, way less processed stuff, walking more, reduced alcohol, reduced soda and pop. And my friend was floored. They were like, what? Really? You did it? Just because I told you, you did it? You just did it. Well, what if we all acted like that was possible, more than possible, expected, and that it started in the hospital? It is so tough to eat well in there, but when do you need it more? And if you have a restriction, as so many do, like full fluids or, God forbid, a special texture, puree, even just dental soft. And if you don't have someone outside who is gifted, seriously, and has a lot of extra time to cook for you, to supplement what you're receiving, if you don't feel well or need assistance to eat, or you have low mood, like, you are facing a serious uphill battle. Because beyond the challenges to eating associated with illness itself and with what's on the tray, people also face mechanical challenges getting the tray set up, opening packages, proper positioning, getting the food in the mouth without chucking it all over themselves in the bed or chair if you are lucky and you're sitting up. There are not enough staff to assist. And there's the inflexibility of the service. There are many hours of the day when food is actually seriously unavailable beyond like apple juice and cookies. At the heart of it all is a disconnect between the patients and the providers of care and the administrators who make decisions about where resources are allocated, what we consider to be our scope, and what we measure and evaluate. And nutrition has been relegated to the sidelines. When I looked at the funding sources for much of the research I was reading, Nestle, Abbott, etc., the liquid meal replacement folks and the makers of the pumps that push them in. And there is a place for that, right? But there is also a place for real food, although they lack the advocates to fight for it. And on that note, I want to introduce today's guest, Jushna Maharaj, chef, author, teacher, activist, and speaker. This interview was recorded a while ago. Jushna was at a cottage, so you can hear the wind and birds in the background. And now we welcome Jushna. Welcome. Thank you for joining me here at the bedside. You. Can you just introduce yourself in the way that you feel accustomed or that you prefer?
Sure. I'm Jushna Maharaj. I'm a chef, activist, and author. I live in Toronto, and I'm very, very excited about getting people connected to good food.
That's wonderful. So you've written a book.
Yes.
Take Back the Tray, Revolutionizing Food in Hospitals, Schools, and Other Institutions. And as a nurse, watching people eat the food that we serve in our institutions, I have to say, perhaps revolutionizing that is an excellent plan.
It really is. I appreciate it. All right. I thank you for that endorsement. It's you all see this meal after meal. It's not even day after day, right? It's meal after meal. We see these relatively miserable trays of food being put down in front of people who need much, much more than we're offering. And so thank you for seeing it. And it's something that has gotten way worse than it needed to, you know? We just, it's been unaddressed for far too long.
It really has. So why don't you start by just describing a bit about what drew you to this mission?
Precisely in institutional food was never specifically my thing. And before I got involved in this work, I was doing community food security work. And that is really just about grassroots kind of food systems and figuring out really how to maximize access to good food for everybody. And then there was a hospital here in Toronto who wanted to make some change. They reached out for help, and beautifully this landed in my lap. But I have to say, the minute I heard that there was a hospital ready to talk about this, I jumped in, because that enthusiasm is a rare find. Right. And I thought, okay, if they're ready to have a conversation, then let's do this. Because here, the one thing that really was compelling for me was that I was previously cooking lunches at a community food center. And this is, you know, very, very humble, minimal budget for any of that. And we were still able to put wholesome, delicious, nutritious food on that plate, even for, you know, for a fraction of what you would spend for a lunch out in a restaurant or anything like that. And that really struck me, because I thought to myself, if I can do this here, why on earth can't they do this in the hospital? And that, to me, I was like, it doesn't make any sense right now. And so I was like, let me get in there and see why it's in such a dismal state.
So we'll get to that part, but can you just begin with, you said delicious, nutritious, wholesome.
Yes.
Can you flesh out those ideas a little bit?
Yes. So the first piece there is I am intentionally moving away from the word healthy. I think it is too loaded with ideas of people in lab coats wagging fingers and telling you all the things you need to stop eating. And it just, when people think about healthy food, they don't think about food that is delicious or joyful. And I firmly believe that you do not have to surrender joy and pleasure for health and wholesomeness. Also, I really want to expand how we understand food and what our food needs to be. Healthy also just kind of connects us to counting carbs and fat and protein and that sort of thing, with really no connection to how the food was grown, where it came from, you know, who the people were, any of that. And so I prefer to use the word wholesome, because it gives more description about the kind of food that I think everybody should be eating. And wholesome is like when the food that's on your plate looks pretty close to the way that thing looked when it came out of the ground, is the connection that I want to make, because that to me is the most important piece. Then I think food has got to be affordable, right? If it's not affordable, it's not going to work. Everybody should be able to afford to eat well, and eat good, wholesome food. And then it really needs to be delicious. We don't need to give that up, right? Part of the joy of life is food, right? There's no way we need to give that up just for something that is going to be better for our bodies.
So hospital food and delicious. Okay.
I know. It's just this idea, right? Because the culture that has grown around this is so peculiar, because for sure there's a bit of like paternalism from the institution, and that the institution knows, you know what I mean, what you need for good health and education, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But there, why it has to be that stuff is like is a sort of swill that you kind of have to plug your nose and choke back, is what I do not understand. I don't understand where that came from. I don't understand why we have let it persist this long, because it is completely untrue.
The other concept you talk about in your book is hospitality. So
yes.
Yeah. Do you want to describe like how you, I mean, even though it has the word hospital in it, I don't know, the way that you describe hospitality, that's not exactly what we're serving up with our trays necessarily.
No, it really, so let's back up a little bit. Hospitality is a guiding principle for me as a chef, right? This is all of us in the industry operate with hospitality as our guiding value, right? And very basically, hospitality, it describes the relationship between a guest and a host. It's sent at the very sort of grassroots of it all. The linguistic connection is actually pretty beautiful, but let's go through the sort of the history of it is interesting. So hospital, hospes is the Latin origin, the origin there, but that means, that is the hospes means stranger in Latin, right? And it was really about the idea of welcoming people in, you know what I mean? And host to stranger kind of relationships. It doesn't matter who these people are. If they have arrived at your door, you have their, you know, this is what you will offer them. And there's lots of definitions about hospitality, but quite basically it's about setting a place for somebody. It's about thinking about provide, you know, their needs and anticipating what they might want and making that available, making people feel welcome and comfortable and well cared for is really what hospitality is about. All right. There's some, you know, fancy restaurant people who talk about that our experience of hospitality first is in the womb. Right, or being fed by our mothers right after birth, and that to me is a really guiding principle. But I remember sitting in a hospital atrium in Toronto with that lofty definition, and then looking around at this place and seeing those trays, and I was like, "So what's happening here? You know what I mean? Where's the disconnect? Because the trays that are being fed to patients in this place, this hospital, feel like quite a distance away from this grand idea of hospitality. And that was been a lot of fuel for me, because what I have essentially my verdict on all of this is that the very thing that has been removed from hospital food is in fact the hospitality, right? Which is about the human connection. Right? The hospitality is about the people-to-people connection, and that is the thing that has ironically been eliminated.
Especially now, I think, you know, over the past year and a half, 2 years, there's really been a lot of increasing visibility and discussion around who is a hospital, you know, hospitable to. And there are large segments of the population that do not find the hospital a welcoming, warm place that feels as though it is a space Indeed. For them. And so maybe this concept of hospitality has a lot to do with that.
I think you are totally right. Right. And it also rolls into the fact that we don't really pay attention to preventative care in health, right? It's all this very sort of like therapy disease-based thinking, so that you don't belong in a hospital. You don't go near a hospital. Unless you absolutely have to be there, right? They are now sterile spaces. They are not welcoming spaces. And that's, to me, that's just a real missed opportunity, right? The fact that we have pulled all of that connection out of our therapy and our care for sick people I think that there's actually, there's a, like, not healing isn't happening as fast as it needs to, right? I don't know what the best way is to say that, but I think that this disconnection has having a detrimental impact on this, the pace, you know what I mean? And realness with which people get better, right? I don't think that time in a hospital helps you get better at all, right? You do your time and then you get out.
Yeah. I mean, certainly care happens there that is absolutely necessary to healing. But we could, you know, one of the things I hear my patients say the most is that they say this is not nourishing.
Yes.
This food is, how am I supposed to recover and gain strength from this?
Yep. Oh, that's exactly it. Because essentially that pile of food on that tray is really quite empty. From a nutritional perspective, yes, the carb numbers and the protein numbers may say what they want, but in my opinion, one of the real like vulnerabilities or Achilles heels of this type of thinking is that it assumes that all calories are created equal. And I believe they're very much not. There are good calories and there are not so good calories. And unfortunately, those calories that are on hospital trays are of the highly processed, not great, not much goodness is actually going to happen to a body after eating all that. And I remember first looking at that tray that was going up to a patient. And my first thought was like, you know, 250 mils of good proper chicken broth and an apple would actually be a much better thing to send than this whole parade of nonsense.
Well, and so much of it is wasted.
Yes. Well, this is the other piece, right? That was when I spent one lunch service in my first hospital just standing, waiting for the carts to come back from the rooms to see what the plates looked like. And that is the most truth-telling moment of all. Right? When the lids come off and the staff are scraping plates into the garbage, right? We're looking at almost 40% of what went up there came back and went directly into landfill.
Yeah. And that's right? Just the stuff that's come back because some people are dumping it into the garbages in their rooms. Or
right. Okay.
It's not all coming back with the trays.
There it is. And then the added piece of the fact that the infection control requirements in the hospital means that nothing gets reused. Nothing gets sorted, no organic spin, nothing. Everything, cans of Ensure, whole pieces of fruit, everything into landfill. Garbage, right? Once I realized that this was just all, most of the food on that tray was just taking a long road back to the garbage can, from the freezer to the garbage can, I was like, this is a mess. This whole system is a mess.
It's very, very wasteful, and there's also a lot of garbage generated.
Yes. From the shipping it to the packaging to the and the repeated packaging. It's the packaging it arrived with, and then the packaging it gets in to get up to paint, like, and then the plastic bag it has to go in to get thrown into the garbage bin at the end of it all. It is a completely wasteful system. And that is, like, that's really it, right? The fact that we have accountants essentially making these decisions. If this system was in fact working and feeding people and, you know, and people were enjoying it, I wouldn't be as up in arms as I am about it. But it is not working. It is wasteful. It's disrespectful. That is, as a cook, right? That really gets me. The disrespect that's on those trays to people is really what I think we have to stop doing, because that's another hospitality piece, right? Because the tray, that plate of food and that tray of food is reflective of the attitude that produced that tray of food.
I watched as a patient of mine. He was an Italian man, and he was a chef and owned restaurants in Italy, and he was visiting Canada. He had been admitted to hospital. He removed the cover from his tray. And I'm reminded of this because you said, you know, it's not respectful. And he screamed, he shouted, he said, "Oh my God." I was like, "What's wrong?" And he said, "This is not food." I was like, "Oh, I'm really sorry." And then, and he was shocked. He was truly, utterly shocked. He said, "How am I going to eat this?" I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Okay, well, just take it away and bring me like a San Pellegrino." And I was like, "Ooh, I have a second piece of bad news for you. Oh, no. I can give you tap water and styrofoam." And he was just like, "What are you people doing?" But I'm reminded of that when you say that it is disrespectful. I think some of the anger and the frustration that I see from people and their families when they're admitted is around a sense of feeling disrespected or disregarded because of what is served to them. I have not heard anyone put it that way, but I think that kind of is clicking for me.
That moment, right? You know that moment when they lift that dome off above, you know?
Yeah.
And I know, God bless them, everybody is secretly hoping that it's something delicious underneath.
Yeah.
And then they see what that is. And to me, that moment, the emotion and the sound of that moment is, you are not worth any more effort than this. Right? That is the message being delivered by that tray from the hospital to the patients.
I gotta say, one of the strongest sources of dissatisfaction, not just definitely for the patients in their sort of feedback and frustration towards us, the nurses, the people who deliver the meal trays, the dietitians, is around the food. And then when we do our satisfaction surveys and our evaluation of a patient's experience, we do not ask them about their experience with food.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're collecting our metrics around satisfaction and performance, it has nothing. It's like a black hole. It's not addressed or evaluated.
Yeah. Fascinating. That's news to me. I didn't realize that it in some cases potentially been either pulled out or never even made it into the questions that you ask patients.
Yeah, the survey that they receive upon discharge to sort of evaluate how we perform has nothing to do with the food. This was actually noted by one of the dietitians that I work with.
Yeah, that's a really important piece because I've always thought that part of the reason why there weren't bigger numbers of dissatisfaction on those surveys was because they were giving patients the surveys on discharge. And that when you are being discharged, you will say whatever is required to get out of there, right? And so that I had this hypothesis that the numbers were artificially inflated because people were like, yeah, 5, 5, 5, 5, 5. Let me get out of here.
These ones are actually mailed to them after they've been home.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That is okay.
Yeah. And nothing to do with the food or the nutrition or feeling of nourishment. Although I have seen some stats, not from Ontario, I don't believe, but that a significant portion of people leave the hospital severely malnourished.
Yes, those are Ontario, University of Guelph. There's an awesome sort of think tank team of folks who year after year, write these academic papers talking about how hospital patients are chronically malnourished populations.
Even if, you think about some of the people who we discharge, and as more and more home supports dwindle, and as we send people to long-term care facilities where, there's chronic understaffing and real challenges with maintaining any standards there as well, to think that we are sending people home malnourished is really difficult to swallow.
It's not, it really is.
Yeah.
Right? It really, to me, I was really like, oh my God, we have to stop and really think about this, everybody. What is happening right now?
We do. So we've sort of discussed the problems. We've discussed the challenges. It's wasteful. It's not nourishing. The food comes across long distances. So there's a huge amount of carbon footprint and plastic waste associated with this food procurement and creation system. And then we've got a sense of dissatisfaction and disrespect for the patients receiving it, and the additional impact of leaving people actually malnourished. But you went into a hospital and you tried to do something different.
I did.
So let's hear a little bit about some of the solutions or ways of trying something new that you found.
Mm-hmm. So as a cook, my top priority there was about scratch cooking. I realized very clearly that no real change was going to be made to those trays unless we were actually cooking the food on site. And that is, if we have any hope of getting to a place where there are actually therapeutic benefits of that tray for people, once we actually get there, it's going to have to be about people cooking food on site. And so that was the first move. Now, I was fortunate in that the funding that I had to be in there in the first place was about finding ways to put more local food onto institutional plates. And kind of beautifully at the time, local processing of raw produce was not a thing, right? That processing is happening other places in Canada or outside the country. So at that moment, local food automatically meant whole food that had to be broken down on site. Which I was delighted about. I was like, these two automatically go together. If you want local food, that means you have to accept whole food and scratch cooking. They go together. That's just it. And I was happy that that was presented that way, because I was not excited about us trying to get machines to start doing things. This is not the way this is going to work. The industrial food system is not going to meet this need. So scratch cooking was the first piece, but listen, that sounds all fine and good. But what I slammed into immediately was the fact that I had a very, very bare bones staff of people. There's not enough staff to cook food from scratch in there. There currently at that point, there was one cook who was responsible for putting meals together for 324 beds.
Oh,
right. This is it. And so that the vast majority of her work was about putting on a parka, going into the freezer and grabbing bags of stuff, putting it in a steam kettle, and then finishing it all with a cornstarch slurry to attempt to put some life back into this food. Right? Everything was pre-cooked and frozen, so she literally is just warming it all up again. And I thought to myself, they call this efficiency. Right? They call this smarter working with lower inputs and whatever it is. But the idea that one woman produces food for 320 is crazy. But when I saw this happening, I remember thinking to myself, how on earth am I going to get this operation to move from one person to 324 to a crew of people peeling potatoes and chopping onions and sauteing things and building flavor? This seems like the most ridiculous request, or like the distance that I have to cross here is huge, right?
Yeah.
It's like, what on earth are we trying to do? So we said one step at a time, and we focused on broth and stock and not like weird chicken broth that technically contains no chicken.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? Those powdered things, beef broth, chicken broth, all both curiously vegetarian.
I have noticed that. I've been able to reassure the vegetarians, like, actually, it's, you're going to get the same thing on a new tray.
That's it. And, like, in the hospital I was working in, there were 5 big, giant steam kettles. Big, like, I could jump into them big.
Wow.
And they had all become extremely expensive utensil holders. Right? Nobody was actually making any stock in them. And so I thought to myself, okay, this hospital kitchen is not going to work if we don't have a serious stock and broth game happening here, because that is convalescing food. That broth is the base of all of the food we give to people to get well, because it is, you know what I mean? Your body doesn't have to work too hard to process it. It's full of good nutrition, ideally, anyhow, you know, for when you're not well. And so we went back to, like, how are we going to make chicken broth? How are we going to make veg broth? And then what rolled from there was the idea of making congee, because I was in a hospital in Scarborough and there's a very, very big Southeast Asian population. And congee is essentially a cooked down rice porridge that is ubiquitous in the Chinese kitchen. And it is the thing that Chinese grandmothers make for their children and their grandchildren when they're not well. And so I thought to myself, why on earth? Well, why aren't we offering this to people, right? This seems like an easy, easy fit. So broth and congee was the easiest way to start, because getting entrees going was, with the complication around the labor was laughable. So just to give you an illustration of exactly the madness we're dealing with, I wanted to take toast off of the menu because we couldn't do it well, and no piece of toast could survive the journey under that sweaty dome. You know what I mean?
Oh, I've seen it. I do.
It's such surrender for that poor piece of already highly processed bread. So it's not even to say whole grains can keep that thing together, because that's not even happening, right? And then just to make things worse, in Scarborough, for whatever crazy reason, we had a refurbished Tim Hortons bagel toaster. And the reason that's important is that a bagel toaster only toasts one side. Right? And so we were sending people toast that has only been toasted on one side. And it was just like the madness of a patient saying, is this really true? Are the budgets so tight that we can now only afford to toast the bread on one side? Is this really where we are? And unfortunately, the answer was very much yes. And so, yeah, let's just take the toast off. We cannot do toast well because it is too steamy an environment. Let's take the toast off and let's put something on there that can benefit from the extra steam, right? I would much rather put a, like, maybe it's, you know, maybe not a classic breakfast thing, but if it's something that's in better shape, made with some thought and care, I was convinced that that would work. So I came up with a frittata, right? So great. Frittata, you pull it out just before it's done. That extra steam and the journey up to the room will be just enough time for it to be perfectly set by the time it reaches the patient. Right. And this is a doable thing. This is a known thing for, like, catering service and that sort of thing. So what we had to do, though, was figure out how much it was going to cost labor wise to pull off this frittata. Because if I'm substituting, I had to see where the labor budget was going to come from for the frittata based, you know, in comparison to the labor required to make that toast. So I had to go in myself and crack 210 eggs, because of course I was insisting we had to crack fresh eggs and not use the weird liquid stuff. So then they had to time how long it took to crack 210 eggs, make the mixtures, put it all, set it up in the fridge, wipe down the counter at the end. And for me, that was a 90-minute effort. So then, because the toasting, the toast labor is on the tray assembly budget line, and the frittata production labor is in the production budget line. So, like, the amount of hoops and paperwork that we had to go through to move the labor from the toasting to the production made my head spin. And I thought to myself, oh God, we're going to have to do this for every single item that I want to change on this menu. We're going to have to figure this convoluted scheme out. But yeah, so that, like, that's just an example of the depth of the bureaucracy and the madness.
I mean, you're talking to a nurse, nothing shocks me, but
you see it, you know it, right?
And you have to think back to, cause I work with some people who've been at the hospital that I'm at for, you know, 25, 30 years, and they remember when there was vats making broth and when, yeah. people right. used to cook there and that the food was quite good. And the same food that would be on the patient's trays was served in the cafeterias, and many of the staff would preferentially get their meals from that cafeteria. So it has been done.
There it is. And that is, to me, that is such important wisdom, that the ideas that I come up with and that other people who do this work come up with are not new granola hippie ideas, right? These are actually, this is the way we used to do things. And I feel like it is super important for us to remember this, because we need to connect to the fact that these are our systems. And if we built them, and if they are not serving us, it is our job to change them so that they do serve us really well, right? We can pull this back. We decided to take a turn, which means we have the power to undo that and make new decisions, right? This is not something just like imposed upon us that way.
So beyond the having to reorganize labor and sourcing of materials and rewriting the budget, you allude to some barriers around how this change was perceived and received. I mean, any kind of organizational culture, in my experience, when you introduce a change, sometimes there's friction or pushback from unexpected places. And
yes, so much. Oh man, these were hard lessons, important ones, but man, they were hard lessons. And a lot of this came around labor. And the human labor in the kitchen, right? These are union staff who work in these kitchens. And as you have just said, many of them are there for this is their entire career is spent doing this work and in these jobs. And there's a certain promise, you know what I mean? Of a pension at the end of it and earlier perhaps retirement than others and that sort of thing. When it really kind of hit me was when a newspaper, the Globe and Mail, national Canadian paper, wanted to do a feature on the project, which I was very excited about. And they ended up giving us a 2-page spread in the Saturday Globe, which is some awesome real estate. I was right. That's major real estate. I mean, hilariously, in the middle of it all is a photo of me with a hairnet on. But anyway, I was delighted that the conversation had reached this level. Right. And that we were ready to talk, or at least somebody was ready to talk about hospital food and why it's in the state that it is. And so I was thrilled about it. And I floated back into the kitchen on Monday morning, expecting that everybody else would be just as thrilled about it and that we'd have a bit of a nice celebration that this had happened. And I was completely wrong. That was very much not what I stepped into. In fact, I walked into a very tense and hostile environment on Monday morning. And when I went in to talk to the director of nutrition about what happened, she really explained to me that regardless of the intention, everybody, all the cooks, everybody who works on that team read that piece and felt as though they were being personally attacked. Right? That they were being critiqued for the quality of the food and the dismal service and the all of it. And unfortunately, what I was not realizing was that, of course, any newspaper article about this is unfortunately not going to write about the incredibly intrepid hospital team that has been making it work, you know, with decades of budget cuts. Yeah. They're gonna talk about the unsexiness of this horrible food. The key piece there was positioning me as a savior who was coming to swoop in and make everything better. Right. That was not the attitude that I had. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that it could be one that was perceived both by the team themselves and then just in how other people want to tell this story. They're like, oh, Josna, you're here now to fix all these problems. And while there was a part of me that was like, I'm going to do my very best to see what I can do. That is not at all the answer, right? That is not the solution. That is not the best way to build allyship and get a team motivated to do something, because they all felt really, really defeated. And they didn't speak to me. Nobody made eye contact with me. I think they all wished that I would just pack my knives and get out of there.
Ooh, tough day.
It was rough. It was super, super rough. Yeah.
So how did you rally after that?
So I realized first that this was my problem to fix, right? I may not have caused it, but I was like, no, you have to do something. You have to sort this out. And what I landed on was the fact that these folks perhaps weren't as connected to how much this project meant to people outside of the hospital, right? Because they hadn't necessarily read any books by Michael Pollan or watched Food Inc. or, you know, had been connected to this growing momentum around questions about our food and our food system. And so they had no idea how actually revolutionary this project was and what a giant deal, you know, their effort was, specifically that there were people who were very excited about it, right? That it wasn't just, oh, fix this terrible problem. And about me, right? It's about that entire team that was going to do something differently. So I honestly rallied my own troops, and I sent out this mass email to my entire food community. Anybody I knew who was connected to food, chefs, doctors, farmers, restaurateurs, like everybody. And the subject line was, our hospital project needs a little cheering section. right? And I wrote them a message and I said, this team is a bit disconnected from our community and from this reality. And if I know that you are all excited about this project, so could you please take a moment and send me, I need a message to send to this team about how you feel about what they are about to do. And I was like, I'm actually getting a little choked up just thinking about that moment, because I spent the next 2 days with my inbox overflowing, full of messages, right? Everybody was so happy to do this. And at the end, I probably got about 35 notes. And I literally went like elementary teacher school style and got some like colorful bannery stuff for one of the boards in the hallway, you know, in the kitchen itself. And I put up some colorful paper and a little sign saying this, like the feel good board. I printed all these messages and I cut them out and I put them up on the wall. And I said to everybody, okay, everyone, please, when you are having a rough day, when you are wishing that I never walked into this kitchen ever at all, please just take a moment and read one of these messages. The messages are specifically to you all. This is not about me. This is about you. And I want you to see what your work and what this project means to the people outside of this hospital, because this is not about me. This is about what you are doing. And so for a while, people are like, yeah, fine, whatever. Because they had already, you know, had their idea about me. But I will tell you, 2 or 3 days later, one of the tray prep folks peeked their head into the office I was in. And she said, hey, I know this TV, you know, it was like a CBC television person, that they know about this project. They know what we're doing. And I was like, they do. And you see, they're so excited about it. And slowly that started to work. Slowly people were like, oh, they read the messages that were addressed directly to them. And I was so thrilled that I was like, okay, I was blanketed everything with apologies and said, please, please, everybody, just connect to the fact that this is way bigger than you might have originally realized.
That's a neat story. I mean, I think I can identify with those food preparation workers sometimes. You know, you go in there and it's not maybe the most glitzy or glamorous part of the hospital, and not a lot of positive feedback for a lot of effort.
No, exactly.
Right? And kind of being set up to almost, it's kind of beyond you. It feels beyond you as a worker in an institution sometimes. And then,
And listen, to that point, that's a wonderful point, because it really struck me with like, yes, this is a good wage. Yes, there's job security. Yes, you have advocacy with a union. But what does it feel like to do your job for 25 years and know that you're actually not being that effective?
Yeah.
Right?
And to get a lot of negative.
Seriously.
You know?
I mean, just a fair wage is not enough to have to deal with that, I think, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So how long did you spend there? A year?
I got funding for 1 year, yes.
Oh, good for you.
And that is really a part of the Achilles heel of my projects, is because they're so reliant on funding to mostly just pay for me to be there to get in and work through things. I never seem to get more than a year's worth of funding. And that's what halts a lot of, you know, big change making, I think.
Yeah, is the budget. So were you required to actually, I mean, when you talk about, we talk about the barriers to this, what, from your perspective, after having had the experience of that year, are the greatest barriers to making food delicious, nourishing, and I forget.
It's two things. One is just general change making itself.
Yeah.
Right. Because I was attempting to pull the reins back on a train that had been in motion in that direction for like 30 years. Right. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to pull the reins back and send it in another direction. That task alone was major. But the other piece is, what I know now for sure is that the real problem with institutional food actually has much less to do with money, although money is a significant barrier, and it has much more to do with the attitude that thinks that this is okay to serve, right? That was the harder piece, is actually getting people, getting administrators to care about food as both just in general, but as a legitimate therapeutic tool. Right? That distance. And that's what sort of opened my mind a little bit to ask questions about the doctors themselves, right? Because they could be great allies for me. But for whatever reason, at the time, this was 2011, was my first project, the doctors were not with me. And I did not understand what that was all about. And even to this day, the only thing that seems to make sense to me is the fact that they are given such superficial teaching about nutrition in medical school itself, that it just doesn't come alive for them unless they themselves choose it, right? The doctors are not, it's just not a part of the entire story. And so that, to me, the putting food literally back on the table, you know, in a therapeutic context, and embracing change are the two biggest obstacles. That's my assessment for sure.
Yeah, I can see that. I think
it's not the money. We can figure the money out.
We feel at the end of this pandemic, there's a couple things that this pandemic has really brought into stark relief when it comes to food. I mean, number one, there is budget when we really need it. There is budget. Number two, we rely, the way that the bad, sort of the lack of nourishment in the hospital food affects people does not affect everyone equally.
Yep.
There's an equity issue to the food that we serve. And when we shut family out during the pandemic from the hospitals, the impact of that food on people became much more evident, because if you had someone who could drive there, bring you homemade food, drop it at the hospital, maybe get it up to you, you did not have to rely entirely on the food.
Sure,
the hospital.
You were protected from it a bit.
You were. And before, family was a huge part of feeding people, physically feeding the people and also preparing the food and bringing it in and advocating, filling out the menus, all of that. But that's not available for everybody.
Yep. And in regular terms, never mind pandemic terms.
Absolutely.
Right?
Not even in regular terms. Absolutely not. And then there comes to the point of cultural food. We are a very multicultural society. People have food preferences when they're sick. Sometimes I see people come in and the thing that they want to eat after surgery, I'm like, really?
Okay. Yeah.
Tell me about this. Like that is different from what I would crave after a surgery.
Like in a sense of like major flavors and things like that, like big flavor and big intensity.
Like what I'm specifically thinking most recently was a woman, we had a good laugh. She had like a spicy fish, goat and pepper soup.
Nice.
Right after. Wow. Yeah, it looked amazing, but I was also yeah, she was from Nigeria. Very different. And she laughed.
Awesome.
She's like, yeah, right? And other people would have something very different after surgery.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And I remember this in watching South Asian patients navigate their first tuna fish sandwich.
Oh.
Right? On white Wonder Bread, on white bread. And me thinking, oh my God, why can't we just make some dal and rice for these people? This is what they would eat at home, would be dal and rice or khichdi, which is a more cooked down version of the two together. I remember visiting patients and saying, how would you feel right now if somebody brought you a plate of dal and rice? And he like perked up. He was like, can you please? I shouldn't have brought it up. I'm sorry.
I know. I've definitely had that request as well. Like, well, could you just get some dal and rice? Or I've had a patient say, the food here is very solid.
Right.
From people whose cultures are typically have more soup.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly the truth. And we, I mean, look, it makes sense that if we are okay with trays that don't really respect and acknowledge people's humanity, it makes sense that cultural diversity would never make it into the picture, right?
Yeah.
I got it. We have to walk before we run on that. However, particularly in this country where we are so layered and diverse, really remembering that cultural foods are a huge part of healing will serve us really well, right? And why couldn't we do a little cursory investigation of the food served for healing and for convalescing around the world?
That is a really great point. Yeah, why
can't right? It's not that hard. It is not that hard to figure out what it is. A lot of it is soup and broth based, and it's very gentle. In fact, I was quite delighted to discover that early versions of fettuccine alfredo was one of those things.
Yeah, that would be great.
Right? Because it's not actually supposed to be a cream sauce, right? That creaminess is supposed to happen with the convergence of butter, parmesan, and pasta water. Right? And so it's a very simple, easy thing. And as far as the Italian's concerned, gentle on the stomach, right? Because, I mean, there's a bunch of dairy and stuff in there. But I like that idea. I like that idea that this is the emergence of fettuccine alfredo was as hospital food first, not as a you know, a proper dish like that.
That's a interesting idea.
It's a wild thought, right?
Yeah, I could get behind that. I really could. So Joshna, you are welcome to just say not interested in answering this question or discussing this, but if you wanted to, I would invite you to discuss your own use of foods in your own healing, whatever you've recovered from. You could discuss how you personally have found, you know, what foods and access to decent foods meant for you in healing from your own experience.
Oh man, I would COVID. Be very happy to answer this one. The lessons have been massive. I mean, even just simply in the chance to walk my talk, right?
Yeah.
I got COVID this year, and that happened in January, and it was really rough. And honestly, it was really rough for me, and I had a relatively easy go of it. I did not get very sick. I remained at home. You know, nothing was that dramatic, but it felt horrible, and I was way too. I was definitely not in shape to cook for myself. And thankfully, I have wonderful people who started just leaving jars of bone broth at my door. And I really, really learned about, one, just the kind of food that I need to eat to restore my insides, right? Because COVID did a wonderful job of just sort of knocking me down and depleting everything. But it was like, honestly, I had to learn to allow myself to be cared for and to be taken care of, right? I spend most of my time taking care of other people, but this was one of the first times in my life I ever really, really needed other people to take care of me, and specifically with food. And it was wonderful to see, and I learned so much about how these simple things like broth and vegetable soup and, you know, the easy little bits of poached chicken. One of my sweet friends brought me a jar of broth and a beautiful tray of already chopped up vegetables to make my own homemade pho. Right. And he did all of the work, sliced poached chicken, the cucumbers and the fresh leaves and all. Right. And he did some thought about, like, these are all really good, organic, well-grown things that will fortify your insides. And that bit of care and attention, I was so grateful for it. I felt better eating it, but it was more than just the food itself. Yes, I got beautiful food, and I have farmer friends who sent me lovely things. Like, I have a very wonderful network of people who are concerned about me. But it was just the fact that somebody was like, you are not well, let me give you the best thing I have to get better, you know?
Yeah.
I learned such a personal lesson about that, and it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And while I was so pitiful sitting on the couch watching RuPaul's Drag Race, binge watching RuPaul's Drag Race, right, I had these moments of just being like, oh, thank you, lovely person, thank you.
Oh, well, that is a wonderful note to end on. May everyone in their illness find the kindness and skill of and bounty of the earth to make their insides feel better, as you say.
Oh man, I love that's a beautiful thing to end on, is to, like, especially in this moment, right? And the fact that we are hopefully emerging from a pandemic, but to remember that although the world is so wild and crazy, we can still trust this land, and the food that it produces, and that there is deep, deep nourishment there for all of us still amidst all of the madness that is still there. So even if you're not super sick, but especially if you are, please, please connect to that, because it's that is how we're going to rebuild and get healthy to move forward.
And we as healthcare professionals, even tired as we are, and food service professionals and administrators, would do well to pay attention to some of these basic elements. The idea of food as respect, the idea of food as nourishment and healing and growth and good for the earth as well. So thank you for your time, Joshna.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for asking these questions and opening up this conversation.
And thanks for continuing to do this work. And hopefully it will spread and grow and bring health and nourishment to more people.
Yes, there's lots of promising signs that that is the case.
Well, I certainly hope so, because we need it. Thank you, listener, for joining me here at the bedside. Please take a moment to follow the link to the survey in the show notes. I'm hoping to evaluate the content of this podcast, so if you could take just a moment to give a bit of feedback, I would be very appreciative. This season of At the Bedside is supported by a grant from the RN Foo Registered Nurses Foundation of Ontario Nurse Innovator Award and from a Sinai Health Science of Care internship. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or follow At the Bedside on Twitter or Instagram. Big gratitude, as always, to the incredible nurses of the 14th level at Mount Sinai and the nurses on 7 Nephro and 4 Chest at St. Joe's in Hamilton. You are all beautiful examples of what nursing can be. Thank you.